We're going to start the meeting, even though we do not have a quorum, because the at least the first bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So if and we're changing the order, so if Representative Brainerd, if you would come up and we're moving them up because they drove a long way and were late, and the weather outside is not too hot, and they need to get back home to Mankato. So I would move that House File 2937. Don't move it first, and then we leave it. Would be recommended to pass, and ultimately it'll be a laid over for possible inclusion. But Representative Brainerd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your consideration for my testifier. I'm glad for this opportunity to introduce Open Door Health Center and our request for $350,000 in transitional funding. Open Door is currently designated as a federally qualified health center look-alike. The journey to this designation has been long and varied. Open Door began as a grassroots organization in a community that has a long history of collaborative partnerships to address community needs. In the late 80s, a broad-based group of community members, including many healthcare professionals, birthed a number of community initiatives as a response to identified gaps in community health. One of those initiatives was a teen pregnancy prevention program that evolved to a responsible sexuality education effort. I worked for this program the last 7 years before I was elected to the legislature. Another of these programs was the Open Door Clinic, which began as a partnership with our local hospital and was intended to help people gain access to existing healthcare services. The service needs and the clientele took Open Door through several transitions with a variety of community supports, including United Way, until 2001, when Open Door received a CAP grant. I have a couple of friends with me today who will take a few minutes to bring you more up to date on the current needs of the Open Door Clinic. Annette Macbeth has been on the board and is a past vice president of the Emmanuel St. Joseph's Hospital.
Mr. Chair, my name is Annette Macbeth, as Representative Kathy Brainerd has said, and I've been with Open Door since its inception. And what I think is most important today is for you to hear from one of our consumers. Her name is Cecile DeFeet, and she is an immigrant to this country, is on path to become a citizen. But I'm embarrassed to say that it was a bumpy road for her as far as health care is concerned, both from a medical and dental standpoint of view. So I'd like to introduce her at this time. She leads a program called Walking in Two Worlds, which is really helping new immigrants and refugees get settled in our new country.
If you could give your name just for the tape, the person who's going to testify next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Cecile DeFeet, and originally I'm from Sudan, and I immigrated to the United States in 2003, and I lived in Chicago for 2 years before I moved to Mankato, Minnesota. I moved to Mankato, Minnesota 2005 to study to become a community health worker. And I worked as a part-time project coordinator for Walking in Two Worlds at the YWCA in Mankato. And when I moved there, I needed health care, and I applied for Medicaid, and I got turned down because I was making more money. That's why I got turned down, and I wasn't poor enough to be qualified for it. And I didn't have insurance at that time because I was part-time. So I asked around, and I said, should I just go back to Chicago, or is there any other solution? And there was. It was Open Door Clinic, and I was just relieved to be able to be seen somewhere in Minnesota, in Mankato specifically. So I went there and I said, I don't make enough money to pay you right up front, but if you can work out some kind of a payment policy, then I'll do my best to pay it off. The following year, I had dental problems, and I again applied for Minnesota Care, and I also get turned down because making more money and not poor enough to qualify for it. So, and I still did not have dental insurance. So, I went there and I said, here's me again, still don't have insurance, so hopefully you'll be able to see me for the second time and still can work up a payment plan so I can pay it off. If Open Door Clinic did not would have exist, I probably would have had two options, either to go back to Chicago and ask my brother to help me get a ticket and go back home, or I probably could have just been addicted to painkillers. So I work with immigrants and refugees, and we get lots of them who do not have health care. And every time when we get them settled, the first thing they ask for is that, where can we go for medical assistance or medical help, or where can we get any medical services? And the first thing I ask, if you have health insurance, you can pretty much go to any clinic or any hospital. But if you don't, there's only one place you can go to, which is Open Door Clinic. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And I have to ask, because your English is so good, did you speak English before you came here in 2003?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
We were colonized by the British, so our second language is English.
Okay.
Thank you.
I had a question for Ms. Macbeth, I think it was.
Yes.
Could you explain to us what's the difference between a FQHC look-alike and an FQHC? I mean, I know what an FQHC is, but the look-alike part, I don't.
The look-alike is we qualify for the federal reimbursement for FQHC funding. But what we're now on track for is what we call FQHC New Start, which gives you additional dollars, particularly to serve the uninsured. And we serve, as you can see in your handout, approximately 80% of the people that we serve are uninsured. And so we see this as a way to be able to expand in serving that population, which is growing in your area. One of the other statistics that you see is that in our particular region, the number of uninsured is at a higher rate than the state average. And we are in competition nationally with other states, obviously, that also have uninsured. And so we've made a strong case for our part of the state. We're also the only community health center that's an FQHC in southern Minnesota.
No.
So we draw from a nine-county area. On the map.
Mr. Chair, we also have the director of the center with us, and she might be able to give you a really on-target response to that difference.
Okay, go ahead. And state your name, please.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, my name is Sarah Cruz. And really the, in a nutshell answer to that is we do not receive the grant funding that FQHC New Access Points receives. So those that are FQHCs will receive up to $650,000 a year to help support the programs that Annette Macbeth has described. We get the additional reimbursement for the Medicaid and Medicare patients, but not the grant funding. So that's why that 80% uninsured is a challenge for us, because that increased reimbursement has limited impact with only 20% of our population having coverage.
Okay. Any other questions? And so I thank you for the trip up here, and what we will do when we get a quorum, I will move to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the finance bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you for this opportunity, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Next, we'll hear from Representative Erdahl with House File 2671. Yeah, and this does have a fiscal note that we'll try to fix before the final bill comes out. And so this bill will also, when we have a quorum, the final motion will be to lay it over for possible inclusion in the bill. And I will unofficially move House File 2671 be recommended to pass. And Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate your comments. You want to do the A1 amendment now as well?
Whatever you need to get the bill the way
I
you
need
want.
That. You can't consider motion. Otherwise, Representative Olin.
Okay. Well, why don't you? You may be. We need one more. Describe the A1 amendment. Is it a delete all?
Well, the A1 amendment simply includes Pennington County into the bill. It removes Renville and puts in Pennington, a nursing home in Pennington County.
Okay. Okay, why don't you go ahead and describe what we're doing here.
Thank you. This bill is about protecting the pension plans of hardworking laborers in the long-term care field. It concerns four nursing homes represented by Representative Hamilton, Shemansky, Representative Olin, and myself. These homes were governmentally owned, and the workers were under PERA. The homes have now been transferred to a nonprofit, and the pensions are now non-PERA. The bill allows pension costs for certain nursing facilities, these particular ones, to be treated as PERA contributions. When a facility converts from government to private sector control, PERA contributions are no longer made, and a facility incurs new pension benefit costs that are not automatically recognized under the Alternative Payment System, or APS. In general, the APS recognizes only those operating costs that a facility paid at the time of signing the APS contract, plus any inflation adjustments provided by the legislature. This bill would allow these non-PERA pension costs to be recognized in a facility's payment rate as if they were PERA contributions. Essentially, it's like the state received a windfall. This money, the PERA payments, were being made, they were expected to be made, but because the nursing home changed to a private ownership, the state doesn't have to pay that money anymore. If this bill is not done, these costs will fall on the backs of nursing homes and the backs of the workers. So essentially, there is no additional cost to the state in terms of the general fund, but there is a different that is accounted for in a fiscal note in money that could have been saved because they weren't having to make these payments, but now they would continue at the same level. You have done this before with Lake City. And again, if this is not done, the money saved by the state would become expenses to be paid by the homes, many of which are already under serious financial constraints. In the end, it would be the workers who pay. And these are people whose wages we essentially froze a few years ago. We owe it to them to protect their pensions when we can. It wasn't their fault that the nursing home was sold, and they shouldn't bear the expense. Please recognize that there is really no additional cost to the state's general fund, that precedence has been set, and that the pension plans of our workers must be protected. I do have a couple of nursing homes.
Well, I want to say, introduce yourself, state your name, if needed on the tape, and then make your presentation.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. My name is Mary Ellen Wells. I'm the president and CEO of Hutchinson Area Healthcare and the Burns Manor Nursing Home in Hutchinson. And I'm here representing the other facilities as well. Those are in Lakeside, in Lakeside Nursing Home in Dassel, Colonial Manor in Lakefield, Oakland Park Nursing Home in Thief River Falls. So the four of us are here with the same common dilemma. And I must say thank you for summarizing. I won't belabor any more details, except just to say that this transfer of ownership really didn't change the economic dilemma, that we do need to continue to fund our pension benefits. It's a different mechanism than has been used in the past. From PERA, we're transferring to a 401k or 403b. We still have those costs. And to have them not recognized in our reimbursement formula will really create a hardship for our organizations. We have combined 271 employees, and the impact is about totaling about $450,000 a year for the four sites. So it is a huge impact to us, and we would appreciate your recognition that this is pretty much of a cost-neutral event for the state, and hopefully you'll be able to rectify through this legislation to correct the situation for us. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My name is Bill Ward. I'm administrator of the Lakeside Healthcare Center in Dassel. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I have, because our last hearing had some confusion, even after our best efforts to explain this, we did provide you a tutorial of the actual math, and it looks like this with the black stripe on top. And I won't go through the language of that, but again, it's just an example of how the state treats us prior to this bill and after this bill, and emphasizes again that if we are successful here today and through this session, we will cost the state no more money than had we not privatized a year ago. It's very budget neutral, and we just wanted to graphically give you that example. And I'll cut it short with that, and except to say that I see this as all about our employees, all about the people that are taking care of Grandpa and Grandma, and doing a good job for not so much pay every day. This is really all about keeping their pensions intact.
Yeah, I have one question. Is did you go from public owned to private for-profit or not-for-profit?
My facility went from a publicly owned, which is a wonderful thing for us because as a publicly owned facility by a small Minnesota community, we had no future. We went to a non-profit, faith-based organization in which we do have a future. So this was a good thing for us, and nobody knew this was sitting there waiting to bite us when we did this.
If you go to for-profit, then there's a problem that you have to pay property taxes, and the state doesn't recognize that as a cost either. But that's not the problem with your case.
We are a non-profit, faith-based organization.
The fiscal notes were just handed out, and the representatives, do we have a quorum?
Yes, we
do. I'll call the meeting officially to order, and I would move, first let's go through the list, House File 2671 be laid over for possible, House File 2937, which we heard earlier, that's the group from Mankato, and I would recommend that House File 2937 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Any discussion of that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? And now we'll move to this bill, House File 2671, and I would move that House File 2671 be recommended to pass, and there is an amendment to that. It's the A1 amendment, which we have two
Mr. Chair, I'll move that amendment.
One is a 1205, and which one do we wish to deal with first, Representative Erdahl?
Mr. Chairman, I think we should do the 1205 first and then do the A1.
Okay, I would move that that we approve the 1205 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So we are now working off the 1205 amendment. And Representative Erdahl, do you want the Second Amendment?
Yes, Chairman.
Then I would move the A1 amendment. And any discussion of that amendment, Representative Erdahl described that before most of us got here. And it changes some of the particular counties that are involved in this. I mean, Representative Mr. Chun.
Mr. Chair, I'd also suggest for the A1 amendment that staff be instructed to make whatever technical changes are needed to make it fit to delete all amendments.
So I would move the A1 amendment and direct staff to make whatever technical corrections are needed. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. So we now have the 1205 amendment, and which have we attached the A1 amendment to that, and Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Chairman. I do have one more testifier, just a short testimony from Greg Cabell from DHS.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Greg Cabell from the Department of Human Services. I'm here to perhaps answer any questions you may have about the fiscal analysis for this bill. It is our department who put it together. It will be changing for two reasons. A, the bill was amended, and B, when I initially did the fiscal note for this bill, I was thinking at the facility level. The handout that Mr. Ward gave you showing the differences between how it's cost neutral. At a facility level, it really is. They're not looking to get a big increase or really any increase to speak of from this bill. They're looking to keep pension costs in their rate. From the department's view, we have the forecast to deal with, and we assume the forecast in the way it's developed picks up changes in all sorts of medical assistance programs, and therefore if you have a law change that you need to bring before a committee, that must mean there's an impact. So it assumes the forecast has accounted for these changes by the way it analyzes trends, and therefore the fiscal note must show the change from that assumed current law.
This was the Ball?
Cabell.
Cabell.
Yes.
Are you planning to do a newer fiscal note on this one?
Yes, sir, I am.
And when, because we're going to have to put this bill together at the end of the week.
The work that needs to be done to revise it has already been done. It's running through channels through the department and through finance.
Okay, well, if you could get that to us as quickly as possible, we would appreciate it.
Yes.
We have a couple people with questions. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm Representative Erdahl. Thanks for trying to explain this. I'm kind of struggling to understand this, but I just wanted to, I don't want to take a whole lot of time and take us too out of the way here, but I was intrigued by the statement before that this went from a publicly owned facility with no future to a faith-based nonprofit with a future. And I'm just wondering, I mean, that's kind of made me curious. I don't want to take a lot of time on that, as I said, but I'm just kind of wondering why, maybe you could kind of address that, but also why sort of in that transition. Surely this issue about the pension costs must be something that people are aware of and kind of take into consideration when that transfer is made, or would that not be the case? I mean, this can't be something that is blindsides people, can it?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in actuality, we were blindsided by this one. The language that is currently causing this challenge for us was passed in the last legislative session, and our efforts and due diligence were actually begun prior to that legislative session. Facilities that privatized prior to 2007 do not face this issue. I never did see a bulletin or anything on it until we raised the question and actually asked DHS to confirm that we didn't have an issue. and we were surprised when we found out we did. So in essence, odd as it should seem, that's exactly what happened.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I gather then from what you're saying that if we did this for you, that you know, for others going forward, we wouldn't have the same problem because they presumably would be on notice. And I mean, are we going to be asked? I mean, I understand the point that there's no cost because we're not getting a decrease that we otherwise would have gotten. So, you know, is it then that if we fix this problem for those of you who were kind of caught off guard, that going forward we're not going to have the same issue arising?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would say that fixing this for these five facilities fixes this for five facilities. The structure would still remain there, and there are a lot of very stressed nursing homes in Minnesota that are soon to be facing the sale block or facing the same situations that we had in Dassel, in which we have a non-viable owner struggling to get out of the business. And the fact that the potential purchaser now is aware of that doesn't change the underlying difficult situation that a nursing home might face. And in fact, it could make it unsellable and therefore closable, where a little help in a corner or two might just make it a viable mission yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to go on too long with this, but then it sounds like maybe we need to go back and revisit that change if it's, you know, rather than having people constantly coming back. I mean, we all know that there are many more problems facing nursing homes, and this is just a really small part of the issue, but, you know, maybe that's something we ought to look at.
Representative Houston. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is something we did this for nursing home representative Anzell's district last year. And I think the way we deal with this going forward is all these transfers come through the Pension Commission to allow the public employee. The only reason this is an issue is because these former public employees stay in para going forward. And so I think what we probably have to do is just deal with this APS issue at the same time we deal with the transfer. And so I think that should be we just need to be aware of that going forward. But I think Representative Morrow has a similar bill coming up next. You know, I think it's a legitimate problem that it's an equity issue that we ought to solve for the nursing homes that got caught up in this. But you're very right that we need to keep our eye on it when we deal with it, when we deal with these transitions in the future.
Representative Abler.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. What bill was that in? Was that in the Human Service bill or in the pension bill?
Which one?
The change that happened last year that they didn't find out.
Representative bill for Representative Anzell.
No, but they said that something changed. The people who sold earlier.
Mr. Chair, the change was forcing to go to the APS system. In 2006, we did that.
So that little change just caused this to happen.
I think that's what the deal is, yeah.
Right. And, Mr. Chair, how many public nursing homes are there left that this is going to be an issue for coming up in the next time? Does anybody know that? Maybe Mr. Tabell knows or somebody.
And relaying, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and relaying from Mr. Tell behind me, he says 45.
Just last question. So we took some savings then with that APS. Was there a little fiscal savings that we must have taken then last year?
I assume there was. Definitely. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a fiscal notice.
Yeah.
So it's in their projections.
Sure.
As a saving.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
Representative Gutwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to comment, I support the bill, but if we're going to be doing this 45 more times or some denomination of that, maybe we ought to think about doing the big fix and just fixing it for all of them that are in this situation.
The squeaky wheel gets greased. So any further questions? Then I would move that House File 2671 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So thank you for coming down here, and I think some of you came further than the people from Mankato.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, committee members, and hopefully we can get this situation straightened out.
Thank you. We're going to deal with House File 3009, Representative Morrow.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Morrow. I would move House File 3009 be recommended to pass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I do have a DE1 amendment that makes the language identical to the language you just looked at, just with a different nursing home.
Okay, so I would move the...
I think that's maybe coming around right now.
Okay. And this is a delete everything. So I would move that House File 3009 be amended by the DE1. Delete all amendments. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So, Representative Morrow, we now have your bill, I guess, in the shape you want it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. To be brief, I think Representative Gottwald suggested I simply say ditto. But it's the same situation, just a different nursing home. Again, a purchase was completed December 2007. The city of Gaylord was no longer in a position to operate its local nursing home. And it contacted potential buyers who added assisted living and other services, but they also had public employees who are now private employees. Yeah. And the nursing home owners came to me, asked me to try to do the same thing the Representative Erdahl just did. I'm happy to answer questions.
Any further questions? Ditto. So I would move that House File 3009 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor of laying the bill over for possible inclusion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So we have laid that one over.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
What does a no vote mean on that motion? I mean, we keep talking about it longer? Is that the...
Just curious. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
I don't know. Okay. Next we'll do... House File 3409, Representative Peterson. And I would move House File 3409 be recommended to pass, but we're going to have a fiscal note, so it'll essentially be laid over. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Chair Huntley.
And you also have people who came a long way.
Yeah, Morin. Way out west. Thank you, Huntley, and members of the committee. Today we are in front of you proposing to, for your consideration, $50,000 from the Healthcare Access Fund for the West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance. This amount of money would continue operations for this group for the next 3 years. Until product launch, if you will. We've been in front of Chair Thiessen's committee for a couple bills. This would be the third piece to keep funding the effort. And with me today is the research coordinator and the leader of the Healthcare Purchasing Alliance in Western Minnesota, Professor Greg Thorson from the University of Minnesota at Morris.
Would you state your name for the tape, please?
Yes, Chairman Huntley and members of the House Healthcare and Human Services Finance Division Committee. My name is Greg Thorson. I am the research coordinator for the West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance. And the West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance is a group of small business owners, healthcare providers, and insurance agents that reside in the 12-county area of West Central Minnesota. I did ask committee staff to include a handout for you, and you can see then the location of those 12 counties on page 2 of that handout. Our mission is to offer more affordable, high-quality health insurance options for small employers and residents in our region. We've held numerous public forums in the region and have administered hundreds of surveys to our area businesses. We are registered as a purchasing alliance with the Minnesota Department of Health, as provided for by the Minnesota Community Purchasing Act, passed by this legislature in 1997. And I've served as the West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance's primary research coordinator since the group's formation in 2003. My academic credentials include a BA in political science from Augsburg College in 1988 and a master's and PhD in political science from the University of California at Riverside in 1995. Since 1995, I have been employed as a political science professor at the University of Minnesota at Morris. However, the views I'm expressing here are solely mine and do not necessarily represent the views of the University of Minnesota or the Board of Regents. As you know, rural Minnesota is in a healthcare crisis. To measure the extent of the problem, our purchasing alliance administered a survey, a scientifically sampled survey, to our 12 county area businesses in the summer of 2003. We found that steep healthcare insurance premiums are threatening the ability of our area employers who currently offer healthcare insurance to continue to offer healthcare insurance to their employees. An alarming 55% of employers indicated that they're either very or somewhat likely to drop healthcare coverage for their employees if premiums continue to rise at their present rate. In fact, more than 1 in 10 employers, this is 11.1%, have already discontinued offering health insurance to their employers in the past 5 years. That's the result of a survey that we administered in 2003. Further complicating the matter is the national trend that small employers are much less likely to offer health care insurance for their employees. On page 3 of that handout in figure 1, you can see there's a very strong correlation between business size and the ability to offer health care insurance to your employees. For 3 to 9 workers, you can see there that only 52% of employers nationally are able to offer health care insurance to their employees when they have less than 10 workers. For large firms, in contrast, 99% of those firms can offer health care insurance to their employees. So then this trend, though, presents a very difficult challenge for our region. In our 12-county area of west central Minnesota, over 75% of our businesses have fewer than 10 employees. Our primary message, then, that we bring to you today is that rural Minnesota is in the midst of an enormous and consequential healthcare crisis that is distinctive from the healthcare crisis that is found in the rest of the state. Our economic base in rural Minnesota is different. Our main streets are overwhelmingly lined with small businesses. Farms that employ a small number of people are also significant contributors to our economies. So just as we experience the problem of the healthcare crisis in rural Minnesota differently, we also believe that our solutions might be different as well. We believe that it's critical for rural Minnesota to have organizations like our Purchasing Alliance that are actively looking for healthcare insurance solutions that work for our small businesses and farmers. We know that it is not just a health care insurance problem in rural Minnesota. Lack of affordable health care insurance threatens the very economic viability of our region, as the lack of affordable health care insurance undercuts our small business startups and local entrepreneurship that are central to our rural economies. This is far more than just a health care insurance issue. It's about economic viability. The $50,000 appropriation requested for the West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance by H.R. 3409 would allow us to continue, as Representative Peterson said, to operate for the next 3 years. It is the same request made by the purchasing alliances in both Northwest and Southwest Minnesota and approved by the state legislature. Following the completion of this 3-year period, we expect to be self-sustaining following our health care insurance product launch. We argue that our past activities, combined with our future plans, justify such an investment by the state. Since our formation in 2003, we have had healthcare insurance forums throughout our area. We've administered scientific surveys to gain a better understanding of the healthcare crisis in our region and suggested reforms to make existing government healthcare programs work better for rural Minnesota. Two of our bills currently in the legislature this session offer creative solutions to address the healthcare crisis in rural Minnesota. The first offers a cost-effective reform to Minnesota Care that addresses the number one complaint that we hear from our rural residents, that the $10,000 inpatient hospitalization cap in Minnesota Care does not adequately protect their small business and farming assets. The second bill provides for a stop-loss fund provided by the state at a very reasonable cost to offer a direct financial incentive to fully insured partners to work with the small businesses of rural Minnesota. We believe that our work holds promising opportunities. We are currently holding extended productive discussions with fully insured health insurance partners to offer quality, affordable health care products for our region's small businesses and their employees. The new plans that we are in the process of developing have the potential to be significantly less expensive than existing plans, due in part to the possibility of a state-supported stop-loss fund, but as well as the possible savings made possible by pooling and the modest health care insurance requirements requested by the small businesses in our region. Our Purchasing Alliance operates on a very lean budget, but additional resources are needed for us to continue our work. As I stated earlier, we are requesting the same amount of financial support that was provided by the states to the Purchasing Alliances in northwestern and southwestern Minnesota. We just want to warn the committee as well, that, and the legislature, that our experience has been that in the absence of incentives and or organizations such as Purchasing Alliances that can more effectively work with established insurers, fully insured partners are reluctant to work with our region's small businesses. We have found that many fully insured partners are less comfortable working with rural employers, especially the small businesses that characterize the base of our rural economy. Thank you for the consideration of our request.
Okay, any discussion? Representative Gottwell.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. So we are putting $50,000, or being asked to here, put $50,000 into, I believe this actually funds another bill you're sponsoring, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwell, this would fund the organization and the continuation of this Healthcare Purchasing
right.
Alliance, of which they have two initiatives that you've heard on health policy.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. We're providing state funds to subsidize or underwrite what amounts to a co-op or an opportunity to provide small employers pooled coverage. We've had several of these things come before us. Do you have co-op coverage in your area? Do you have cooperatives that are offering coverage?
Mr. Thornton. Dr. Thornton.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm actually not aware of whether we do have any co-ops that are operating in our region, but we are not formed as a co-op. We are formed as part of the Community Purchasing Act of 1997 as a purchasing alliance, basically allowing the coming together of small employers to pool together to purchase health care insurance.
Any other questions? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and this isn't a question, but just a point of clarification, in that your description of the economy in your rural area is exactly the exact same as my 13 neighborhoods in northeast Minneapolis, small, you know, independent businesses, vacant storefronts, mostly a lot of independently employed people. They may not be farmers, they may be small handyman or contractors or, artists or, you know, people who do graphic arts or do independent computer programming. But I do caution all of us in terms of sort of owning a problem in any part of the state, because I think the entire state is wrestling with the same issue of how to affordably provide health insurance to small businesses, independently employed people. And so just... I think we just need to recognize this is a huge statewide need, and I don't think it's unique to any particular part of the state. I think you've worked on some creative solutions and are to be commended for that. I just want to say we're more alike than we think sometimes.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Thornton, I am wondering, in your testimony you talked about this request being like two other requests that have come before the legislature and have been funded, and I'm wondering the source of those funds. If it came from the Healthcare Access Fund or if it came from another fund.
Okay. Mr. Thornton.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm actually, I don't recall, they were, Representative Huntley might recall because he played was also participated in the Purchasing Alliance movement. So I'm not sure whether they came out of the Healthcare Purchasing Alliance, I'm sorry, the Healthcare Access Fund or not. Mr. Chair, may I also respond to the previous comment as well?
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, and Representative, I think you're exactly right. That the issues that deal with small businesses in Minnesota, there are lots of small businesses that have some common underlying sets of problems for access to affordable health care insurance. But there are some elements that are unique as well, and we should come together because all of the districts have these small employers. But we have found that there are some issues that are unique to rural Minnesota small businesses and rural Minnesota farmers in particular. We found that, for example, when actuaries are estimating risk of our area farmers, we're being pooled with very dissimilar populations that have much higher risk than the farmers in our area. And it's because we have an underlying problem of access to health insurance, especially among agricultural communities. So I think you're right. We can all fund together to come to help small businesses. But we are interested in looking at, well, what does this look like in our region? And we are finding some, for example, 55% of the businesses in our region that offer health care insurance are somewhat or very likely to drop insurance. I think we can contribute some things from our region specifically as we form a first in line.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, your background is insurance. You're an actuary.
I'm a research coordinator for the Purchasing Alliance, and I'm a college professor with a PhD trained in political science and public policy.
Okay. Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, so where is the confidence with knowing that this is going to work from an insurance perspective, that you're going to be able to deliver savings and lower cost to small employers, that you're going to be able to deliver on the promises? And we've got concerns right now about dipping into the health care access fund. We've heard those concerns expressed before. And before we do it for one area of the state, what's our assurance that this is going to deliver on what your research suggests? I respect your expertise as a political science professor, but this is insurance. This is a different business.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as you're well aware, these are very complex problems. And to say with certainty that the proposals that we're putting forward will solve the healthcare access problems in the state, I'm not coming before you saying that. But I am saying that there's a significant amount of research in the public policy literature that I'm familiar with where pooling can reduce premiums. And I believe you actually said so in the testimony that I delivered in front of the Health Human and the other committee last week as well. So I think pooling offers some opportunity as well. But really, the idea here is that we're out to look for solutions that will bring fully insured partners to the table to more effectively work with small rural businesses and especially groups of farmers. And we're committed to doing that. We've worked with actuaries. The Northwest Area Foundation paid for a summit that we held in the Twin Cities where we brought in lots of actuaries and lots of folks, and they described and helped us develop what's wrong with the way the insurance industry rates rural small businesses and rural farmers. Are those things easy to correct? No. But we've got a significant problem. For example, when farmers are typically underinsured, the people who are taking on insurance as farmers are taking on very high deductibles. It's difficult to get accurate risk assessment from that, and all that stuff is readily available in the public policy literature dealing with access to health care insurance.
Representative Gottwald.
Well, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, I think what I've testified in the past is that pooling is a great way to moderate costs. It will not in and of itself lower costs. And in fact, if you're working with rural constituents, who in fact are a greater risk pool for whatever reason, this is part of why they're being rated the way they are. You're taking on quite a challenge. You're putting together an insurance product, a pooling product, with no assurances that you're going to be able to do what you say. You want $50,000 from our healthcare access fund for one area of the state. This is kind of risky. I would agree with Representative Wofford that what we really should be doing is looking at small group reform that impacts all employers across the state, small employers. We should be looking at other solutions. I think these approaches are rather risky. We put public dollars into these things with a hope, and if they don't work, we're out the money, and so are the people that you're trying to cover.
Mr. Thornton.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think there is systematic, actuaries have spoken with us who have argued that systematically small employers, rural or non-rural, are discriminated against in terms of pricing. I'm talking legal discrimination, that they represent a higher variance in their claims experiences than large businesses. And that instability, regardless of their median expense level, so I disagree with the assumption that rural people actually use more health care. I don't think the data supports that, but just the very fact that they're small increases their variance. It's a fairly scientific discussion, and that in itself raises rates for rural. And so by allowing them to pool together, if you're pooled appropriately, and that's a whole other discussion, can provide less of a variance in the pool and then represents less risk. And you've seen that we've tried to attack that in two ways, by pooling, which brings a larger group of people that will moderate the variance in the claims experience, as well as asking the state to support a stop-loss fund, which would then reduce some of the risk for our fully insured partners as well.
Yeah. I would ask our staff to, and I don't know if the fiscal staff or the health research, to give us an update of what happened with the Northwest Cooperative and the Southwest Cooperative, and also we passed some legislation for co-ops, and what's happening with those. I'd just be interested to know. This issue won't be addressed till I think we're going to vote next Tuesday. Yeah. So, any further questions? Oh, we had, was it Representative Pepin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question you just asked was one part of exactly the question I wanted to ask about a little bit more information about the Northwest and Southwest, because I, too, if there's 12 purchasing pools and this would be the third, then I think we've discussed this on other bills, too. Are we going to have to sit here and listen for nine more as opposed to looking at more of a process statewide? And then I guess my other question that perhaps staff could look into, if we were to apply this type of program to all small employees statewide, how much would that cost?
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to spend a lot of more time on this, but in fact, my question really just related to the fact that this is a request for $50,000. I don't know whether we're going to be able to fund it or not, but Mr. Chair, I don't remember how many millions of dollars we're talking about in the Health Care Access Fund, but certainly we're talking about certainly $50,000. Not that the issue isn't important, and not that we shouldn't certainly look at it as an overarching issue, but I just want to put a little perspective here on what we're talking about. You know, with Representative Gottwald's question, you know, why would we do this $50,000 for one area of the state? I mean, I know $50,000 is real money, but in the context of what we're talking about here, I just don't think we want to spend lots more time on this.
Any further discussion? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thorson, in establishing the stop loss fund, because that's what you're establishing, correct? What have the other purchasing alliances done throughout the state? And I'm sorry, I mean, maybe you addressed that earlier, but I'm at another meeting too, so if you could just remind me.
Mr. Thorson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this bill actually, though, doesn't provide for the stop-loss fund. Those are the two other bills that we have in the legislature right now. This is actually the support for the Purchasing Alliance. And by the way, we are the only registered purchasing alliance in the state right now. So if there are concerns about how far we are the survivor, and I think it's because we've got some different approaches, including the stop-loss bill, and to answer that question, the legislature tried this before, but neither purchasing alliance was able to actually implement it. Theoretically, it is one of the most interesting opportunities for creating health care reform. It's in front of the Healthy New York program. It's one of the big prospects for allowing increasing small businesses to purchase health care insurance. So the legislature, that bill actually recreated, the legislature passed that already, but the funds expired in 2007, were unused. We're asking for the recreation in a separate bill.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thorson, is this product affordable without the $50,000?
Mr. Thorson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we are in the process of developing that product and have other components that would be very helpful and to get a more affordable product, the stop loss. But if we can't continue as an organization, we will never get to product launch. And so the $50,000 is to support our organization so that we can continue to meet, to bring together and inform you about the nature of the problem in our region, to propose two tangible, affordable solutions that would make it better in our region and that will allow us then to complete our negotiations with a fully insured partner. So my answer would be that we may never get there if we don't get the funding that we need.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Thorson, how much will the $50,000 be enough to get you going and you won't have to have any more money?
Mr. Chair, Representative, this is a one-time request, and yes, we think it's enough to get us 3 years, and we expect them to have a product launch within that time frame. And after that, then, we would be a self-sustaining organization through the purchasing process.
Well, in line with Representative Liebling's comments, I want to thank you both, Representative Peterson and Mr. Thorson, for coming and testifying. And House File 3409 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So, thank you for being here.
Thank you for being generous with your committee time.
And I should announce that Representative Clark's bill will be heard tomorrow. They're trying to work on an amendment to make everybody happy. And I think we now have
Representative Doty.
Yeah, Representative Doty, House File 3785. And I've been informed by the parliamentarian that I just need to say I will move House File 3785 for to be laid over and for possible inclusion in the bill. And we will now hear from Representative Doty about 3785.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. There's no need to explain the difficulties that many nursing homes are in. You just heard an explanation of some of the things that make that a little more serious in a small town. And what we're trying to deal with this bill is something that has been done in the past. In fact, Representative Erickson from your committee carried a bill pretty much identical to this a few years ago for another home, which is now in my district. Essentially, what we're looking at here is a situation where a nonprofit, which would not be paying property taxes, is sold out of dire necessity or the doors closed to a for-profit individual willing to take that chance. And now he has the added burden of having to pay the property tax. With that background, I'd like to turn this over to my testifier, Jim Bertram, who will introduce himself and explain a little more background.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present today. Appreciate it very much. I know you have a busy schedule. I am Jim Bertram. I'm my wife, Kathy. I'm a nursing home administrator. My wife is a registered nurse. We currently live in Little Falls. We're the owner manager of 8 nursing homes and 20 assisted livings, all in rural Minnesota. From Blackjet to Winnebago and lots of places in between. The issue we're talking about today is we are the proposed purchaser of St. Otto's Care Center in Little Falls. It's a 118-bed nursing home. The seller is a nonprofit corporation, a hospital, and does not pay property tax. The proposed purchasers, which is ourselves, we will have a for-profit corporation, which will pay property taxes each year between $100,000 to $140,000. This new payment of this $100,000 for property taxes is not included in the current reimbursement system, because when a nursing home converts from a nonprofit to a for-profit, there is no increase in the payment under the current alternative payment system. This has a significant financial impact on the home, the residents, and primarily the employees. Some of the financial challenges, you all know, you've heard testimony before from a lot of other places, the significant financial difficulties that nursing homes are facing. Typically, when we get involved in the process in a rural community, the home is struggling financially, and people do ask us, why would we do this? Well, part of it is, both Kathy and I grew up in a small town, rural Minnesota, and we believe every community has, and the residents that live in that community have a right to the care in their local community, whether that be a nursing home or assisted living. And we have both options. And typically, when we come on the scene involved in the process, we are forced to make reductions. because typically the home is losing financially a significant amount of money. And typically that is reduction in either staffing or benefits or both. And that's very difficult. But I do have to say usually the employees in the local community are willing to work with us because they want to see a future in that community either as a nursing home or assisted living. So the additional payments for property taxes that we will have to make, and this is in also applies to other homes, just lessens the amount of money that's available for staff and benefits. And it does have a financial impact. So our mission, and I guess I'm asking that you would consider this request because it does allow, it is a fairness issue that this would be included in the reimbursement payment. And also it allows us to have the additional money available to pay the taxes, therefore we will have additional money available for our employees for their payment, for their benefits, pay and benefits. Just a little background, currently we're involved in some other communities, but we've also done conversions. Three communities we've converted a nursing home to assisted living, and this is done primarily because of financial reasons in that once a nursing home gets below a certain number, financially it doesn't work very well. Currently we're looking at one community now taking a 45-bed nursing home and converting it to a 12-bed nursing home and 28 assisted living. It's something that we want to try. So I just want to ask that you would consider this request because it is important to the rural community to allow us to keep the nursing home going. And yes, it can convert to assisted living, but it's very difficult when people have to leave their community to go to a nursing home in a neighboring community. People want to be taken care of in their own community, and that is our mission. And that's why we're asking that you would consider this request.
Okay, thank you for your testimony, and I will have questions to Representative Gottwald first.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Doty and our testifier, I applaud you for creativity. This is we know that our nursing homes are in need. It's an issue we're going to be dealing with quite a bit, I think, before the end of this session. One question, is there a fiscal note on this?
The fiscal note's been passed out, and it's what, roughly $30,000 a year.
What we have, though,
$32,000, $48,000, and $48,000.
And does that involve only state dollars, or are we also talking local property taxes?
No, that what this would do is allow them to pay the property tax. So that would be state dollars in the fiscal note. But I think that would also be matched with federal money. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, to the testifier, if we're doing this for one, and to members as well, you know, if we're going to do this for one with the cost to one, why aren't we doing this for all nursing homes? And if so, what would the cost be to the total state? So, I applaud you for doing this for Little Falls, but we've got nursing homes all over the state that might benefit from this kind of thing. I think we heard there were 45 that were being converted from public to private. So, again, you know, what would the cost be to us, and shouldn't we be doing this across the board?
Representative Thiessen. Thank you, Mr. Chair. But first, I think this is a little different because this is nonprofit to private as opposed to public to private. But my question is to the staff, I think, more. Do we have, are property taxes incorporated into the property portion of the late reimbursement for other for-profit? I mean, how does that work for for-profits in general?
Under the previous reimbursement system, it was included in as a payment, with similar pass-through, basically. But under the new, since the alternative payment system has been in effect, it is not.
Okay.
And that is the distinction. That's why it is an issue.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Bertram, does that mean that... in the alternative payment system right now, if you had a for-profit home been there for, you know, 50 years, they would be, that would be included in their rates?
If they had a for-profit home, yes, it would be included in their rates.
Okay,
yes.
So the only ones that get essentially punished are those that switch from...
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Well, we got Representative Abler.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. It's nice to keep your local nursing homes open. We had this situation in our area, and actually a nonprofit, about another nonprofit one, okay. So it wasn't an issue. But do you have a chain of things? Is that why you went to a profit? You have a series of these, and you just put them in your corporation? Is that what you
Well, we have about eight different corporations. Each community kind of has their own corporation. That is a decision we've made to go the for-profit route. I used to work the nonprofit area. And I guess I just believe that it's part of my entrepreneur spirit, and that healthcare should be okay to make a profit in healthcare, and that is our goal. So that is great.
And that's fine. This is always a struggle with some of these deals, and I don't know how big your budget's going to be for maybe $30,000 to fit in. Okay, but I hope we can do something like this. But if we couldn't, you know, on some of these things where the county's interested in having it stay open, it is an asset to the county.
Mm-hmm.
And they would consider abating your taxes should we not be successful with the budget. No, we're a little late on money. Because it's a value. And then it would get spread out to the county taxpayers in lieu of that. But it is funny, all these little oddling rules that we have where they're treated so differently. And I don't know how we ever fix them all, but I hope we can rescue this good facility in the future.
Well, the only logic, seems to me, for this rule is that it would discourage going to for-profit, which would raise what we have to pay. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is maybe more for the committee than our witnesses, but I think as we look at the whole reimbursement system going forward, I think we really need to have some debate about this, because when you go for profit, you get substantial tax shelter benefits. If you paid $1 million, and I have no idea what the price of a 100-bed nursing home or 45-bed nursing home is, but say you paid $1 million, you know, and, you know, 75% of that value for theoretical purposes is depreciable. I mean, you get to actually shelter your income against that depreciation. And so there are offsets to the additional cost. And I think we maybe need to get a little more sophisticated in our rate setting in terms of looking at, you know, how are we treating entities alike and different, and who really has the real dollars to operate, because we do tend to pay, I don't think we recognize the differences in the cost and the benefits of both nonprofit and for-profit equitably, and I think as we look at this, we might want to revisit it next time around, because I think there are some pluses and minuses to each structure, and I'm not saying that, you know, the situation isn't, you know, there, apparently there's precedent here, but I do think that it's an area we really should be a little bit more serious about.
Okay, seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my... Gottwald. Okay, Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Please bear with me. I'm just trying to understand this a little more because I know this is going to come up again. If you're a nonprofit, you're not getting the rate differential for property taxes, and if you move to for-profit, it doesn't follow you into the for-profit status. But if you start as a for-profit, you're getting the rate differential. Is that correct?
That is correct under the current... alternative payment system of nursing home reimbursement, yes.
It seems odd.
Representative Pepin. No, okay. Then I will renew my motion that House File 3785 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So that is done, and thank you for coming to the committee and this trip down here.
Yes. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee, for hearing our testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And members, we've had a whole series of bills from outside of the metro area, and now this is Representative Walker's day on the Hill. So the rest of this meeting will be devoted to a series of bills by Representative Walker for, I think all of them are for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And I hate to say welcome to the committee since you've spent about 6 or 8 years here.
This is eight with you, Mr. Chair. The good times and the bad. Mr. Chair and members, I want to thank you for the opportunity to have these four bills heard. And members, to be more efficient, what we're going to do, I'm going to move all four bills at the same time. There's some brief testimony that individuals that have been working on these bills would like to have, and then we can discuss them. Two of the bills have similar language, and the third bill has language that's in the first bill, so I think it's just more efficient to do all of them at the same time. With that being said, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 3616 to be laid over for possible inclusion. House File 3618 also to be laid over for possible inclusion. House File 3619 and House File 3820.
So Representative Walker has moved that all four of these bills be laid over for possible. We don't have this one?
Mr. Chair, I do have two amendments.
We have one little slight problem. House File 3820 is not in our position right now, but you can certainly discuss that, and probably tomorrow I will move that we lay that over.
Mr. Chair, can I modify that? Because I think it might be more simple for Ms. Corner if I do them individually, because then there can be the two amendments that I do have. So if I can move House File 3616... officially.
Okay, so House File 3616 has been moved.
Mr. Chair, I have the A1 amendment.
And Representative Walker moves the A1 amendment to House File 3616.
And members, what this is actually part of the current bill. It deletes unpaid work as an opportunity for TANF participants to, as part of their compliance to their work plan, and this is putting them back with a consent language from the participant.
Could you explain that again?
So the original
bill was to
delete unpaid work experience completely as part of the work plan, and now this is saying giving more options to the participant and the social workers with unpaid work, but getting the consent of the individual, because there are participants who don't mind the unpaid work experience.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
I understand that we're putting things back, I guess, but on the actual Subdivision 13 and the new language there, it looks like it just rewords what was there. Is there any real neat change except for just drafting?
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abler. Actually, it pretty much rewords it, because currently now it's deleted. So it's just rewording it.
So,
what's the number of that amendment?
3616,
Mr. Chair. No, the bill, but what's the amendment? No.
A1.
So Representative Walker moves the A1 amendment to House File 3616. No further discussion, so all those in favor of adding the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. So the 3616 is now, 16 is now amended.
And then, Mr. Chair, do we need to officially lay that over? It's up to you, Mr. Chair. Well, actually, we can wait and just put them in front of us, I think. Can we do that? Or do we have to lay it over?
Let's lay that over.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, before you lay it over.
Mr. Chair, then I'll move House File 3618.
I just have a question about the bill.
Yeah, okay. Representative Abler.
Well, so we put this back in. What does this bill do?
Oh, Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, we're just moving the bills right now. We're going to hear some testimony, and then we're going to get to the bills themselves.
Okay. Thank you.
Some of the testifiers, some of the testifiers are going to talk about all four bills.
Yes.
So, Representative Walker.
I'd like to move House File 3618.
Representative Walker moves House File 3618.
To be laid over.
To be laid over. And what's your... Anderson, Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, do all four bills then, are they kind of, they all hook together, they all got to go together as a foursome, or they, I don't understand, I've never heard of doing all four bills were being laid over like this.
They all involve the MFIP program, but they're separate bills, and they all need to be, they all have a financial impact, so they're all going to be, the motion will be to lay them over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And do we have fiscal notes on them? We don't have fiscal notes on them yet. So, Representative Walker.
Need to officially lay over 3618.
So she moves to lay over 3618, and now Representative Walker.
I move House File 3619.
She's moving 3619.
And I have an amendment, the A1 amendment. And members, what this amendment is, this is actually part of the provision that was vetoed by the governor last year. Did not believe that individuals should be using their TANF grant to purchase or to do auto loans. And so this is actually changing the opportunity for him. He didn't actually have a problem with the purchase of the car, but not buying loans. And so if you were able to buy a beater for $100 or whatever it is, you are able to get still participate in that program.
So Representative Walker moves, just let me explain what we're trying to do here. And it's not the way we started, but we can only really have one bill up at a time. And so, but the witnesses that are going to come and testify are going to talk about all of them. It's just a more efficient way to do it. So she's introducing or moving each bill, then we're going to lay it over, then we'll have the witnesses, and then we'll have to bring each bill back up and decide to lay it on the table or vote against it or whatever. So that's what we're trying to do. And but right now we're on 3619, and Representative Walker has moved the A1 amendment to 3619. Any discussion of that amendment? Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative Walker, just to be clear, we're now taking state dollars and offering grants for the purchase of automobiles and repairing automobiles.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, this is actually came out of committee last year and within the conference committee. The difficulty, from my understanding that I got from the governor, it wasn't the issue as it relates to purchasing of vehicles. It was the purchasing of a loan and having TANF grants continuously going their own. This is actually going to the community action agency. We already have opportunities for them to do car repairs and things of that nature in Anoka County. They have a great opportunity up there that I'm really familiar with helping individuals purchase cars. The property commission went up there and got a really good education on what Anoka County is doing, for example, helping individuals that are receiving TANF grants purchase cars to make sure they're able to get to and from work. And so it's just working with community action agency and making sure to comply with the governor's request that loans aren't an available option that just purchasing a vehicle is.
Any other questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
So the A1 amendment is adopted to 3619.
We can get some testimony. They're coming up. Cool. And we will try to be very brief, Mr. Chair and members, because many of these provisions were heard last year.
Hi, my name is Linda Delboy. I'm a member of the Welfare Rights Committee, and we're here in support of all these bills. I'm going to talk mainly about 3616 and 3618. These, along with the other two bills, do what needs to be done this year, and that is use TANF money for TANF families. We were here last week talking, decrying the governor's attempt to utilize TANF funds for general fund purposes. These bills give us a way to not do that and use TANF money where it belongs for poor families in the state of Minnesota. 3618 briefly is a small bill. It repeals a provision called the family cap, and that makes it so that when babies are born to a family that to a parent that was already on MFIT, the family's grant does not go up. And we feel this punishes babies for being born and punishes the rest of the family. And it's really cruel considering that the grants are very, very low, many like 65-70% below the poverty level. That is in 3616. Also in 3618. It's also in 3616. Briefly, what 3616 does is it gives a cost of living. It's not even, I won't say a cost of living. It gives a 10% increase to the cash portion of the MFIP grant. MFIP, or i.e. welfare grants, have not been raised in the state of Minnesota since 1986. Meanwhile, the cost of living has gone up nearly 90% since 1986. So you can see just on the first page how low the cash portion is, and if you can imagine trying to raise a family, you can't even pay rent on that. So what people have to do is really patch together some really shaky stuff, and that's just not right. 3616 also recognizes the tricky economic times we're in by giving more.
If I could just interrupt before Representative Walker goes, he has a bill up at another committee, and I want to thank you for your 8 years here. It's been a real pleasure working with you, and I hope no other members of this committee leave. After this next election, it was really fun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been a blast to, the wide variety of issues that are in Health and Human Services. It's a very tough committee to stay on. It's one of those committees that nobody really wants to be on. When you have money, how do you prioritize between the poor, the elderly, the disabled, the mentally ill, and children? And so even like this year, how do you decide who is the most, who's okay to cut? And so it's always a tough committee no matter how you look at it, but it's, to me, it's been the most rewarding experience because you get to impact people's lives no matter what you do here directly. It is human that we are always changing, improving, sometimes hurting, unfortunately, but it's our responsibility to do what's best for these individuals and across the state of Minnesota. And so I thank you guys, and I thank Representative Haas for kicking in for me. While I go do my other two controversial bills.
So, Ms. Gabway, you can continue.
So it gives extensions to the time limit to anyone who's looking for a job. And in these economic times, entry-level jobs, the competition for entry-level jobs is extremely fierce. And we just have to realize that is the reality and give people some help when they're out there looking for a job. This bill doesn't outlaw workfare, which we want to do, but it does leave it as an option for people, but make it very clear that people can't be forced into it. It's kind of the spirit of the law that got passed last year that does allow workfare in Minnesota, but for some people it is an option, and we just want to keep that option for people, but as an option. We repeal the $50 per month cut to the MFIP grant to families who are in subsidized housing. To kind of paraphrase what I heard in a committee last week, $50 to us is like $500 to you. it's serious money, and it's serious. It pays for serious needs. And finally, this bill, as I already mentioned, repeals the family cap. So we urge you to pass it. It's really critical.
Is there another testifier? I would just announce that House File 3820 will not be heard today. Would you introduce yourself and give your name for the tape?
Yes, my name is Tasha Jackson, and I am an activist. I work for Congressman Keith Ellison and Senator Barack Obama, and I just wanted to say that it's very important that we really, really need to pull together and find resolutions and solutions instead of always trying to find an easy way out. Just sit back and think about if you was in poor people's shoes, what would you do if you didn't have enough money to meet your rent, your food, okay?
I am a single adult, and I'm appealing at the county right now for my food stamps and cash assistance, because they think that every able body is able to get out and work. Okay, we are in recession right now. You cannot go out and get a job just like that. We do not have a lot of jobs that are livable wage. And once we do that, have enough jobs that are livable wage, then it may be a different story. But we really need to really think about this and think about if you was in a poor person's place. You can lose it all in one day. It's seen on TV all the time. And I really encourage people to really take a look at yourself and have a heart for people. And me and a few other people at the Welfare Rights Coalition had a meeting with Congressman Keith Ellison yesterday. So he is very aware of what's going on. And he is going to step in to help. So I just wanted to let you guys know that. But just take a look and think about how many poor people that we have in this world. Do you guys even care? Do you even have a heart?
Okay, next, thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jessica Webster. I'm an advocate with Legal Aid. Legal Aid provides free legal assistance to low-income families across the state. And while I could talk and express support for a number of provisions that have been introduced today, I want to spend just a few minutes talking about the family cap. And in the midst of the 2003 budget crisis, the legislature passed the MFIP family cap, as most of you know, and this was to save money in MFIP. Like a lot of other states around the country, Minnesota expected that this policy would deter poor women from having more children. And the deterrent would come by informing poor women that should they become pregnant, the state would not be giving them an additional $2 to $3 per day, is what it works out to help with the expenses of their new baby. But this policy did not stop poor babies from being born across the state of Minnesota. DHS reports that the percentage of poor babies harmed by the family cap has increased every year since the policy was implemented. More than 6,000 babies have been born into poverty and explicitly excluded from assistance. And who are the families that are having these babies? One-fourth of the families affected by the family cap are two-parent families. Members, this is not a place to find savings to the state of Minnesota. And for these families in poverty receiving assistance, many of you know that these families really are expected to eat for about $3 per day per family member. Some of you have taken the food stamp challenge, and you know how difficult that is. So this additional $2 to $3 per day that we're excluding to families who have a new baby, that's $2 to $3 per day for a new baby for assistance for nutrition, health, and safety. And so we hope that you will consider, even in these very tough budget times, ending this policy, which is really sad and really distressing for poor families across the state.
Question, Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and testifiers and the previous testifier as well. We really do have a heart, and it's oftentimes broken, I think, up here, having to make these decisions. But I do want to mention that Representative Iltrema had, and myself had, a bill also in this area of removing the cap for a Pregnant Women and Family Act that we were unable to get before the committee process up here. But I want to speak to that and to this bill because of also we've been approached, myself and others through the Archdiocese of St. Paul, who also are advocating on your behalf. So there are folks with a heart out there working very hard. I've worked for Campaign for Human Development and Catholic Charities for many, many years, and this is a huge issue, and it is very huge out in greater Minnesota, too, where I just want to reiterate again how, you know, poverty has many layers. It's like an onion, and you continue to peel it back. And out in greater Minnesota, the shame and blame is still there. And we need to do what we can. I feel as I'm here voting my faith and standing up for the folks that can't stand up for themselves. And this the other bill that Representative Tremba had would have also gone a long way to prevent the abortions and help people afford to have the babies.
Mr. Chair and Representative, Assistant Representative Otremba, thank you. Thanks for those proposals. We appreciate them.
Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another thing, piece of the cap is we know that from surveys that we do every year that the number of abortions in the state have gone down, but the families who's on MFEP, actually those abortions have gone up by 29%, and so I just wanted to put that on the record.
Representative Liebling.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Otremba kind of addressed what I wanted to ask about. I think that's really important, you know, that sometimes we hear the term pro-life thrown around a little bit loosely, and I would just like to say that anybody that is pro-life in the broadest sense really ought to be concerned about these families.
Thank you. And the next testifier.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Huntley and members of the committee. My name is Alexander Fitzsimmons, and I am the policy director for the Minnesota Catholic Conference. The Minnesota Catholic Conference is the public policy voice for the Catholic Church in Minnesota. I want to thank you also for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 3618, Representative Walker's bill for securing the family cap. Since its enactment following the 2003 legislative session, the Catholic Church has continuously and fervently advocated to repeal the family cap for two main reasons. First, the family cap undermines the sanctity of human life and the respect for human dignity of all persons. The Catholic Church believes, as Representative O'Trendle is just saying, that the family cap forces women who are receiving MFIP assistance and conceive a child more than 10 months after enrolling in the MFIP program to abort their babies. According to the Minnesota Department of Health's annual report to the legislature concerning induced abortions, there were 14,186 abortions in Minnesota in 2002, the year preceding the enactment of the family cap. 18% of those abortions were attributed to economic reasons. In 2006, there were 14,065 abortions in Minnesota. 33% of those abortions were attributed to economic reasons. During the period of time in which the family cap has been in place, the number of abortions due to economic reasons has nearly doubled. While the number of abortions due to economic reasons has increased since 2002, the overall number of abortions has decreased. The family cap ignores and undermines the sanctity of human life and the inherent dignity of human beings, especially the women who are forced to abort their babies and the babies who are aborted. Second, the family cap is an economically unjust public policy. Catholic social teaching teaches that the moral quality of a society is measured by how it treats its most vulnerable members. Welfare policy should reduce poverty and dependency, strengthen family life, and help families leave poverty through work, job training, and assistance with child care, health care, housing, and transportation. Last year, Minnesota punished nearly 6,000 children because they were born into poor families. The family cap threatens the well-being and security of families. In fact, it places greater challenges on families who are working to lift themselves out of poverty and provide their children with more opportunities. In order to build the common good, human life and dignity must be respected and economic justice must be embraced. It is imperative, especially now in our ailing economy, to support children and families who are struggling to make it out of poverty. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzsimmons. Questions? Okay, thank you for your testimony. And would you state your name for the tape, although you've been here before?
Chairman Huntley and members of the committee, I'm Deborah Schlick. I'm the director of the Affirmative Options Coalition.
We're a statewide coalition of more than 50 organizations. Some are nonprofits doing direct service to low-income individuals. Others are advocacy organizations. Others are faith-based organizations like the Archdiocese Office on Social Justice. I'm here to testify on House File 3619. It was part of this bundle of MFIT bills in your motion. And there are two components to that bill, paid temporary work experience and money to help people repair and replace cars. We believe strongly that in a weakening labor market like the one Minnesota's enduring, that things like that funds like the TANF Block Grant ought to be used to the extent possible to help Minnesotans get and keep jobs. We hope the workforce committees that are overlooking the Workforce Development Funds and the Job Skills Partnership Funds look at similar opportunities. So I'd like to speak for a minute to the paid work experience piece. I'll speak as well to the cars. Arnie Anderson from the Minnesota Community Action Partnership is also here if you have questions, but otherwise I may be your last testifier. The paid work experience are time-limited jobs, 3 to 6 months. They are in community nonprofits and local businesses. They are structured work experience that help a parent who's on the Minnesota Family Investment Program, otherwise unable to find work in a competitive labor market, work through this short-term, highly structured work environment and emerge with the skills that make them an attractive candidate to local employers. And our members throughout the state tell us with the funding that was approved by the legislature and signed by the governor last year, that's what's happening. 68, 75, 63% are the sort of numbers they report of graduates of the temporary work experience who then go into competitive labor market jobs. This bill is also important for the budget problems you're facing. It does ask for an allocation, but as you know, the federal government in 2005 made some significant changes to the formula for measuring performance of state welfare to work block grants, making it much, much harder for Minnesota and the other 49 states to hit their performance targets. Failing to hit the performance target means penalties to federal block grant. Next year, that could be up to $13 million. The penalty escalates each year after that. Temporary paid work experience counts as a work activity. It's easily verified. It's a sort of sure addition to the work participation numbers for the state. And we like that it helps the families return to the program and helps employers who are looking for employees. The CARS program in front of you, I want to speak to briefly. The amendment that you accepted into the bill is the language that Representative Lanning was advancing in House File 3208 that went through Representative Clark's committee. As Representative Walker explained to you, in the veto letter last year, the governor was worried that the language about loans instead of grants might not meet all the technical standards that come with the federal TANF funds. So the language that Representative Lanning has been forwarding resolves that problem. And again, this is a key component to helping people get and keep jobs in a very weak labor market. DHS has identified that 86% of MFIT parents without jobs and 73% of those who are working identify lack of transportation as their number one barrier to getting or keeping work. The Wilder Foundation, in a study in 2001, said that private car ownership is the most successful way of helping welfare participants meet their transportation needs. And finally, in 2004, the United States Government Accountability Office, in a report to Congress, said that if there were transportation, many, many of the parents coming to TANF throughout the country probably would not have to turn to the program. So again, we think these are smart use of safety net funds in a weak labor market, and because you expand those needs during a weak economy, it's a smart use of one-time funds that otherwise disappear. Thank you for your time.
Questions? Like we're fully informed.
Sam.
Thank you for your testimony. And now, Representative Haas, do you want to make your motion?
Well,
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if there's any questions from the committee, but a few comments from myself. These bills deal with the reality that we have in the world. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, this issue can be a very political issue, and I think for some obvious reasons. But however, there are the facts, I think, speak to what we can do for good policy and what we can do to get families to work. A few things that we ought to always remember. Individuals on the Minnesota Family Investment Program are families, that have children. And the policy that we enact affects these children. We also need to deal with the realities of what we've done politically to the policy of TANF and MFIP. The average caseload cost today is less than what it was in 1999. We spend over $100 million less in real dollars today than we did in 1999. Oftentimes we like to use stereotypes or we like to use inaccuracies to pull on certain emotions, but the realities and the facts show that we have, I think, moved back from our commitment in a lot of ways. Research shows that opportunities for families, primarily rooted in education and addressing the realities that families need, such as transportation needs, are some of the best ways to get families back to work. And I think the bills in front of you today realize those realities and address this in a good policy approach. Not politically, but policy-wise. And I think this committee needs to sit down and make sure that we make the decisions that are most appropriate, not only for us as a state, but for the families and the children that participate in these programs. And even more importantly, is that moving into a recession, as we are now, caseloads only go up, not because of expansion of programs, but because of the realities of the workplace and the work market. So we have to be there today to make sure that we can respond for the inevitable increases that we'll see. So I really appreciate the committee's time, and I hope that if there are any questions, that we can work on any concerns or questions and not focus on the politics of this issue, but actually work for solutions. So thank you.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for being out of the room. I'm actually in two committees right now, so I'm bopping back and forth. But this is a question actually on one of the amendments that I believe passed, the A1 amendment, the 3616. And this might be a question for staff. I was just curious about the work requirements. I'm just wondering if an example of an unpaid work would be, if you look on the back of that amendment, it lists several qualifications, and I'm wondering if working on a political or volunteering on a political campaign would be an example of an unpaid work requirement that would fit into this.
Mr. Chair, members, I don't know specifically if working for a political campaign is included as unpaid work as it's defined in here.
Well, maybe they could check that out. But
Mr. Chair, I would like an answer on that before we readdress this.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that would be cruel and unusual punishment. Any further discussion? I've been informed by Ms. Holcomb that we've already tabled all three of these so that we don't really have to go through that again. You're having trouble following my parliamentary procedures. I'm beginning to understand why. But so all these were laid over for a possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and we're not going to hear 3820, so we have no other business today.
Mr. Chair.
And Representative Abler.
Could you just clarify, I read your email, but maybe you could just help us, somebody's email, about the schedule for... we're meeting tomorrow to do some more bills.
Right.
At 12:30 or something. And then we're going to, for an hour or two or whatever it takes to get done. And then we're going to meet, then Monday, there's an amendment that's going to be released at 10 o'clock of your bill.
Monday we will try to have the omnibus bill released so that you can look at it. And hopefully you can get your amendments in by 5 p.m. And I realize, again, that there's problem. One of the problems we have is Easter week.
Right.
And we'll try to get that bill out as early as possible on Monday.
Yeah, and then the intent is to meet on Tuesday and mark it up.
Yes.
And one of the staff mentioned that amendments being gotten in, is the intention to offer an amendment? Is that the same as having amendments done? Or?
If you have it to House Research, this is my intent, okay? If you have it to House Research in a form that they can understand, and it may not, you know, they're going to be up all night doing those things.
Yeah.
So if you just have it in there, but it should be a little more than saying, gee, could you fix an amendment for blah, blah, blah.
All right, just curious.
Yeah. And that's my intent. And Representative Pepin, you had a question.
Mr. Chair, when is it that we are next meeting?
Tomorrow. We have a series of bills tomorrow.
I mean next week. When are we meeting?
Next week, we will deal with the omnibus fix-up finance bill on Tuesday.
Okay, are we meeting next Monday?
No, Monday's a holiday.
Okay. Good, that's what I thought. I was confusing that.
Let me put it this way. It's a holiday for legislators. I think our staff is going to be here working very hard. And so we ought to remember that often we go home at midnight sometimes, and they're still here trying to fix up what we did at midnight for 3 or 4 hours.
Mr. Chair, do you know where I worked during the early 90s for about 7 years?
That goes back to cruel and unusual punishment. Representative Abler.
Just to clarify further, so Tuesday I think we come back at noon to session, is that right, for whatever amount of time that's going to take, and then we'll convene whenever that's done. Is that your general intention to, and there'll be some testimony, I suppose, to the bill or not? Not no public testimony, and then we'll do the amendment.
We'll try to keep the public testimony to a minimum. If there are specific questions you want somebody to address, that would be fine.
And most of you will be picking from the stuff that we've heard, and will there be a lot of surprise stuff you thought of over the weekend in there?
I don't think there'll be much surprise stuff. All right. I mean, you know, we're going to be getting our targets shortly,
yeah.
And there will be cuts.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Or to quote a movie title, there will be blood. Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, so we don't have to, we're really clear about amendments, and we wouldn't have to go through maybe oral amendments, is that all amendments are due at latest by 5 o'clock on Monday? Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so anything after that wouldn't be able to be amended.
I think you could do an amendment to say, delete section so-and-so. I don't.
But nothing complex.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, meeting is adjourned.